ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows, founder of the media industry publications Mumbrella and Unmade.
And I'm Dani Syed, media reporter for Crikey, filling in for Vivian Kelly.
Well, today, the Daily Telegraph is in hot hibiscus water for its provocative stunt at a Sydney takeaway. We'll take a look at the ethics around stings and undercover reporting.
And why the TV networks are getting their broadcast license fees slashed again. But first up, Tim, more than 2 years since the launch of ChatGPT, the role of generative AI for the news industry is chopping and changing. How do you feel about it?
Look, Dani, I'm really, really ambivalent, I have to admit. On the one hand, I look at my behaviour as a journalist every day, where I use many of the tools of OpenAI in particular, ChatGPT, just the basics of spell checking, grammar, glorified spell check, I suppose, and it's incredibly useful, and it can be used for other tools as well. But on the other side of the ledger, I watch it basically destroying the industry in which I work. So little bit of one, little bit of the other.
Not to shame you, Tim, but I'm not quite there. I don't trust the robots yet.
Well, that's a fair point.
It's quite the ethical dilemma, and it's quite the ethical dilemma for a lot of journos. And so this week, one that really surprised me, The Guardian has signed a deal with OpenAI, and it'll supply its flagship product, ChatGPT, which we all know and some of us love, with search material and archive material.
I suppose one of the things is, this is just the latest deal, isn't it? The fact that The Guardian are doing it. They're not the first to do it.
That's right, Tim. Last year, News Corp signed a massive multi-year deal. It was reported to be worth $250 million. And the Associated Press also have a deal with OpenAI, but The Guardian are just the second Australian-based outlet to lock into a deal like this. AI is definitely not universally popular in any newsroom, but it's really surprising from The Guardian.
Why do you see it as surprising from The Guardian? Because, of course, this is a way of them getting paid for their content, which is surely the ultimate aim of the publishers when they're in these battles with the AI services.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the one hand, there's this sort of responsibility the news outlets have to an informed news environment. And in that way, it's really great that The Guardian is providing its content and its sort of obviously trustworthy and responsibly sourced content to ChatGPT, and we can build a world in which that sort of material thrives. But there's a lot of environmental concerns about the use of AI that Guardian sources speaking to me have raised. There's a lot of ethical concerns. There's a number of Guardian sources raised a recent Associated Press report about the Israeli military using OpenAI's models in Gaza, in military actions in Gaza. And so there's a real concern there. There's a real concern about what this might look like for people who work in jobs like sub-editing. And so there's a real uncertainty about what this could possibly look like. There's a clause in the recently negotiated enterprise bargaining agreement. The Guardian staff almost went on strike last year, and they included in the new agreement a clause to consult when there's a big change to the use of AI in the newsroom. And we don't know whether that's necessarily happened. Some sources have said that that hasn't happened. Kath Viner, who's the big boss from London, is in town now. She's in Melbourne. So we don't know what that's going to look like.
And on the other side of things, the sense is that the amount of dollars that the AI companies are finding to give to publishers in these deals, they're not huge. They're not going to let them run businesses in the way they used to.
Exactly right. So there's this sort of existential threat, and especially in Australia, where the industry is so small and it's so closed off. Any dollars are good dollars. And do you take the AI money in order to survive a little bit longer? What do you do with the AI money? We sort of saw this a little bit with the News Media Bargaining Code a couple of years ago, where a lot of businesses sort of took a bit of a sugar hit and said, hey, we're going to employ regional journos, or we're going to employ young journos, or we're going to employ diverse journos, or we're going to spend it on new programs. And when that money dried up and went away, we were sort of stuck in a mire a little bit.
Look, I suppose what we should unwrap a bit is why the arrival of generative AI has made such a difference for the publishers. one of the challenges being when you can just, as somebody who's interested in the news, when you can just ask ChatGPT to tell you the news, you don't then end up going onto the website of the publisher. And of course, those who, which is most of them, who make their money through advertising, then don't get to serve an ad. So there's no model behind sending those journalists out to do that research and write those things if there's no way of paying for that journalism. So then we end up looking for these alternative sources of funding, like, as you say, the News Media Bargaining Code, which forced the platforms to pay some money to publishers. Or now we're seeing these kind of deals at the edges from the new AI players.
Exactly right. And when we're talking about financial sugar hits, our next story, the government gave Australia's commercial networks a $50 million sugar hit. The federal government's decided to suspend the commercial broadcasting tax for the next year and saving all of the free-to-air TV networks $50 million in fees, Tim.
Yeah, so what we have seen there is that Free TV Australia, which is the peak body that represents 10, 9 and 7, they have welcomed this week's announcement that the commercial broadcasting tax will be suspended for this year. It's a, you know, it's a nice little gift to the TV networks ahead of the election. But Free TV is arguing that it would like to see that tax ditched altogether.
Yeah, Tim, so what is this commercial broadcasting tax?
Yeah, so we have to look back, I suppose, to the days when television used to be a license to print money, which it isn't so much these days, but it used to be that TV, it wasn't even millions, it was billions of dollars. In order for the right to broadcast to the public and to make all of that money, the TV networks were asked to pay back 4.5% of their advertising revenue to the government, to the public, for that right. Now, in more recent years, the networks have successfully lobbied, and this is governments of both flavours, both the Coalition and now Labour, that times are a little bit tougher, so can they please pay less? And that's been the story of recent years. Which, by the way, Dani, I know we feel sorry for the TV networks, but they did write $3.5 billion in advertising revenue in Australia last year. So there is an argument that perhaps one should justify why they shouldn't pay $50 million for that right.
And they've lowered their fees again and again. This $50 million is a haircut on what it used to be as well, isn't it?
Well, look, it is. And the networks argue that, yes, television is less profitable than it is. The costs of broadcasting things like sport are going up. They also make the argument that they face obligations. They're obliged to produce a certain number of hours of news each week, produce a certain amount of hours of Australian drama each year in order for the right to broadcast. But yeah, at the same time, being a TV network it's not a bad business to be in.
No, not at all. I mean, we can still sort of print money when it comes to sports rights. Those rights deals keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Is there a reason why we can't just get rid of this sort of closed shop model and turn to a free market?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think certainly when it comes to sports rights, yes, the TV networks pay a lot for those sports rights, but they do that because they can serve advertising against it. They can deliver advertising against it. The betting companies, the alcohol companies, all of those sort of things love to be as close to sport as they can get. But yeah, what fascinates me is this thought of, is there some sort of free market model which allows for any organisation to say, well, we're willing to bid this amount for the right to broadcast. And if the TV networks don't want to pay $50 million, maybe somebody else does. Now, later, Dani, we'll talk about broadcasting a bit more with a familiar face looking to pick up Nine's radio networks, with rumours he'll be bringing a juggernaut out of retirement. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Dani Saeed, stepping in for Vivian Kelly.
The Daily Telegraph in Sydney has been fighting a reputational crisis all week after an attempted undercover story went, and I use this word advisedly, wrong. A social experiment, shall we call it, that seemed to be trying to catch a moment of conflict between workers at an Egyptian cafe and a customer, led to accusations of manufacturing the news. In a moment, we'll be joined by journalism expert Alex Wake to talk about the ethics of undercover journalism. But first, Dani, you were the one who got the inside track on what I think the telly was calling Operation Undercover Jew. Have I got that name right? And how did you get that story?
Yeah, sort of, Tim. It was truly one of the only times my jaw has actually dropped when I heard some of the details from the source. So what happened here is the Daily Telegraph visited a restaurant in Sydney's inner west. It was called Cairo Takeaway. It's a very popular Egyptian restaurant, and it's very explicitly pro-Palestinian. It has a big Palestinian mural on the side of the shop front. They got in touch with an individual, and they partnered with an individual who walked into the cafe wearing a cap with the Star of David on it and what appeared to be a Star of David pendant and very thick black wraparound sunglasses. And the plan was, and we know this from documents in the Daily Telegraph's internal systems, to, quote, for him to secretly film with his video glasses for the purpose of a story that aimed to document, quote, what it's like being Jewish in Sydney. And we know from those documents that it had the working title Undercover Jew. Now, we know that this man attended the restaurant, he ordered an iced tea, and he more or less left without incident. And then a short time later, Daily Telegraph senior reporter Daniel Gusmeroli heads in, accompanied by a videographer, and it kicks off this chain of events that leads to an argument outside and the police being called. Now, there's some footage of that argument that was posted on social media early last week, and what was actually said between the parties was disputed. But we have some audio from this man's phone that captures some of the argument between Gusmeroli and the cafe staff.
I don't understand what you're doing, madam. Daily Telegraph, show me a card that you're from the Daily Telegraph. Low-level newspapers egging people on. Why are you
Why did you come out to look at him?
I stand out here all the time.
Eyeballing him.
I stand out here all the time. I'm looking at customers coming and going, madam. It's my job. I have no problem with Jewish people, Palestinians, nothing. I don't care about it.
Now, this man engaged some very eminent lawyers in Rebecca Giles and Sue Chrysantho, who are the Avengers of defamation law in this country. And the New South Wales Police said that there wasn't a crime that was identified, but clearly there's some problems here in terms of journalistic practice. Now, the Daily Telegraph's editor, Ben English, put out a statement and he didn't quite apologise, but he admitted that the paper's approach could have been better handled. He didn't respond to questions from me, but then again, he never has. And he said the master never intended to provoke an incident at the restaurant or report that its staff were anti-Semitic, but acknowledged its approach could have been better handled.
What fascinates me is how you got to see these internal News Corp documents.
Yeah, so Tim, the fascinating part about this is that News Corp's back end, the way it's set up, anybody could have done this. And now for clarity, I'm not suggesting I hacked
into anybody who had access to the News Corp systems.
Exactly right. So anybody who had access, which wasn't me for clarity, anybody in the company could have done this in the sense that if you work at news.com, you can access the Daily Telegraph's topic plan. If you work at the Daily Telegraph, you can access the Courier Mail's topic plan in Brisbane and so on and so forth. And so basically you can, and sometimes it's very helpful for things like sports stories and whatnot where they get shared across a number of different mastheads. But that's basically how we got the story. The social media footage went up early last week and then we saw this in the Telegraph back end and it blew my mind. Now, police said there wasn't a crime that was identified, but clearly there's sort of a number of issues here in terms of journalistic practice. Are you allowed to use secret recording glasses? Can you not identify yourself as a reporter before going in and engaging with a member of the public? So there's still a lot of unanswered questions. And so when is it justified, Tim?
Well, look, Dani, there are plenty of examples where undercover journalism has ended up as doing really important work. Associate Professor Alex Wake teaches journalism at RMIT University. For many years, she was an ABC journalist. Alex, thank you for joining us. And in your view, are there times when undercover journalism is justified?
Look, it certainly is justified in particular circumstances. And I mean, some great award-winning work, you know, from undercover journalists. This doesn't sound like the kind of one that should have been, but certainly, you know, throughout history there has been. Back in the 18th century, going into mental asylums, probably the most famous case of an undercover journalist was Nellie Bly, who spent time in a mental institution trying to show just how poor those kinds of places were back in the day. So certainly historically, but I've got to say it doesn't really happen very much in news today. And for a range of reasons, mostly because it's incredibly expensive to take a journalist offline just to work on one thing, but also it's also quite difficult to go undercover as a journalist these days because everyone has a social media presence. You know, you often, when you go to work for a company or go into an organisation, you'll often have to sign a piece of paper with a, you know, non-disclosure content in it. And if you lie to get access to something, then you're breaking the journalist's code of ethics. There are reasons why at times we will break the code of ethics. And the code itself actually says when there is substantial advancement of the public interest. But, you know, certainly this case does not sound like it was a substantial advancement of the public interest at all.
Alex, you make the point that this sort of work is expensive. How does one balance up when it's worth the investment?
Look, that's a really, really hard question because you never know when you set out on any investigation how long it's going to take, how much it will eventually cost. Back in the day, you know, when newspapers had a lot of money, you know, decisions would be made that you could go ahead with a story even if it ended up in legal action, which would cause a payout or force a payout. Those were actually decisions, you know, conversations I had with my editors when I worked in tabloid newsrooms in the UK back in the 80s. We would actually have that conversation. If we say this and we have to pay, would that be commercially, you know, sensible? But I don't think that most news outlets these days could afford to do that. The quality news outlets are generally running fairly tightly on funding, and I don't know that they would be able to do it. The more commercial media, the ones that tend to like the clickbait, they're going to push it, but they're not going to push it to a stage these days where they're forcing, they're already considering what a payout might be. The lawyers are more likely to try to stop them if they think a payout's going to be there. Although lawyers can be a journalist's best friend, absolutely can be a journalist's best friend and often are. But yeah, even the clickbait types of media these days won't go ahead if they think it's going to land them in court with a very big payout.
Well, speaking of that, Professor, is it legal? Like, take us through, I know there's a couple of provisions in the Surveillance Devices Act and there's obviously some ethical things in the press council principles, but when it comes to the legality, is it legal?
Well, okay. Firstly, I'm no media lawyer and there are far better people to answer this this question, but we would basically teach that you cannot film on private property without consent. It's, you know, and there are plenty of places that enforce that rule, like railway stations, which you think are public, but actually they're not. And, you know, you're often if you walk in with a camera, we used to get chased away all the time. You know, they don't want you there. They don't want you filming unless you've been invited in. Shopping centres, another place where you're not supposed to film. It's private property. So there's actually a whole range of places where without permission, you're not allowed to film. But again, you know, there is the public interest. So there could be cases, and I'm sure lawyers would make cases for public interest if there was a reason to be filming. And I'm absolutely certain that you could come up with public interest reasons to film inside private property if there was, you know, great abuses of power going on.
On Medialand with Tim Burrows and Dani Said, you're hearing from Associate Professor Alex Wake, journalism expert from RMIT University. You've made the point that we now have an age of social media. The other side of that, of course, is we have an age of content creators as well who, you know, there's nothing more annoying than a YouTube or TikTok prank exponent with some version of, oh, it's just a prank, bro, after they do these things. I suppose one of the things is, yes, we have these codes of conduct and codes of ethics for journalists, but does that just become irrelevant when there's so much of this stuff happening in the wider sphere anyway?
Oh, look, social influencers and people who do those pranks absolutely blow my mind because they absolutely have no idea what the law says. And, you know, it is incredibly concerning what you can find online from people now. But I think that that's the difference between a professional journalist and someone who is, you know, just trying to get clicks and, you know, build their YouTube channels. I mean, a professional journalist will apply a code of conduct, and we're trying everything we possibly can in, well, most parts of the industry right now are trying everything they possibly can to actually build trust with audiences. And basic honesty and fairness and respecting the rights of others, you know, they are things that professional journalists sign up to do. And, you know, that's the only way we can distinguish ourselves between what we do and what someone does on YouTube or one of the other social media.
We talk about the public interest assessment and the exceptions that that come with going undercover and not disclosing yourself when there is a public interest element. When is something like this in the public interest? Are there examples of when stories or journalists have gone undercover and come out on the other side justified in what they've done?
I like to talk about people with power and people without power. And there are a lot of people in this world who don't have power, and they are children, and children are often not believed if they tell you something. People with mental illnesses are often not believed when they try to tell something. People in jails, again, not believed. So they are people often without power, and I think that there could be stories there that could be told appropriately in an undercover setting, which would potentially be in the public interest. But, you know, going into a shop where there's a Palestinian flag, I don't think that's really appropriate.
When we talk about going undercover, a lot of people might think of the classic stings on confrontations on A Current Affair or Today Tonight, sort of through the early 2000s. Is that sort of practice, is that more impactful for an audience? Is there any literature on whether that really works and whether there's, you know, is it public interest if the public's interested?
Well, you know, it's those kinds of sort of stunts. You know, people thrive on emotion. You know, we like to be angry. We like to be, you know, sadly, and that's, you know, a big part of what's gone wrong with the media right now is that news outlets, or certain news outlets, not all of them, have discovered that the more emotional they make us, the more we are going to engage with that content. So commercially, it works for them. And that's why those current affairs programs, you know, got big audiences back in the day. But the flip side of that is, you know, a couple of decades on, people don't trust the media anymore. And again, this is this kind of behaviour, untrustworthy behaviour, has had an impact on our profession and what we do, which means, you know, that in the wider sort of society that we're in now, I've been in situations where people have walked past me and just said, you know, there goes fake news. And, you know, it's just a simple statement which undercuts everything we do in our jobs and in our professions. And it's just so terribly unfortunate. I think we need, as a profession, to build more trust. And I think we can only do that by being honest and trustworthy and upfront about what we're doing and where we're getting our information from.
I do just want to sort of push back on that point around trust, because I think there are times when undercover journalism can add to trust in journalism rather than undermine it. Surely there are times when it's absolutely in the public interest for them to do it, and the public will trust journalists better for the information they reveal.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just saying, not the stunts. You know, as we've been talking about, what we've heard in the last week, that was a stunt. And, you know, there is as I was trying to explain, that there are a whole range of areas where uncovering systemic abuses is really important. And, you know, that's what people win awards for. It's why Nick McKenzie is likely to win, you know, every journalistic prize in the country.
Nick McKenzie is a journalist for Nine based with the Age newsroom.
Yeah, and the work he has done through about the CFMEU and the union movement, through, you know, that kind of journalism wins awards, it builds trust, and that is really important. But, you know, stunts, no, not at all.
Alex Wake, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
So before we wrap up, a couple of bits of other business from Nine. Lots of agitation this week for it to sell some of its assets, including the real estate platform Domain and Nine Radio.
Hang on, is Domain being sold?
Well, possibly. That's what developed this morning. So we saw that the US-based real estate company CoStar confirmed that it's bought nearly 20% of the shares in Domain and is put in an offer for the rest. Early on Friday, when the ASX opened after the announcement came out, we saw the market capitalization of Domain shoot up from just under $2 billion to $2.8 billion. So that was a very quick jump.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Nine Radio as well, owns 2GB and in Sydney and 3AW in Melbourne, has a potential buyer. We're hearing Singo's back.
Yes, that's right. That's also being reported this week. So John Singleton, who was the person who helped make 2GB, the Sydney talk station, a, let's say, notorious powerhouse, but certainly a very influential powerhouse, he is expressing interest in picking up the Nine Radio asset. So that's not just 2GB, but also 3AW over in Melbourne. And there's a full five-city talk radio network. And because of the nature of media these days, the chances are Singo will end up paying less, if he gets it, to get the whole of the radio network than he did when he chose to sell 2GB just 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, and we're hearing as well that we might have a familiar face coming back, Tim.
Yeah, we might have a familiar face and a familiar voice. Ray Hadley, who only recently retired from 2GB, is likely to be part of the big team, which makes sense, I think, because he was always very close to John Singleton. So I suspect that will be one motivation. And the other will be, you'd see him being offered a stake in the business to come and help it succeed.
Exactly. Always good having a piece of the pie.
And that is about it for us this week.
If you want to get in touch, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
And remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app. Thank you to our producer, Nat Tenchich. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National. And thank you for stepping in, Darnie.
No worries at all. See you, Tim.
Toodle pip.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.